All right, we're back with another edition of the Falls Cast, brought to you by the Falls Free Press in beautiful Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, where today, July 28th, it is, I think, about 87 degrees and sunny and really a beautiful day today. We're joined by some of our favorite Falls casters, and I want to just let you know that coming up after our roundtable discussion, we're going to be having an interview with a member of the Akron Board of Education, Dr. NJ Akbar, who has a really interesting Facebook series that he's been doing, sort of Zoom calls. It's called Perspectives with Black Men. It's a very interesting way of getting, well, perspectives with Black men. They discuss racism and a lot of the things that have been surrounding the Black Lives Matter movement. And Dr. Akbar is going to talk to us to give us some perspective on our own discussion from our last episode about the officer from the Cuyahoga Falls Police Department who had a photo surface of him in blackface. So we're excited to talk to him, and please stay tuned after our roundtable discussion to hear the interview with Dr. Akbar. Also, just want to make sure that I mention once again that we are very interested in having additional contributors to the Falls Free Press, both in terms of our written content and some of our other content forms like videos. And if you're interested in joining us for a podcast, or if you have an idea for an interview or something like that, please reach out to us, fallsfreepress@gmail.com, or go through our website at fallsfreepress.com to contact us. And without any further ado, I will introduce our roundtable participants for today. We have who we all just learned is in fact something called a Swiftie, Mr. Bart Sullivan.
I'm pretty sure that's not the term, but I'm going to let you say it anyway.
I have no idea what Taylor Swift fans are called, so I'm just going with that because it's funny. we have the best photographer in Cuyahoga Falls, as far as we're concerned, except for when it comes to shooting pictures of yellow lettering on Venetian blinds. Mr. Stephen Mule.
Hello.
We have, as always, my best friend, Michael Searle.
I still hate you.
Don't laugh when I say that. It's embarrassing.
I know. I'm sorry. Yeah, well.
We have theater queen Suzanne Searle.
Hello. Anytime I'm called a queen is okay in my book, so.
Fair enough. We have our young friend, he's old in spirit, but not elderly in spirit. Patrick Catanese.
Hello.
And with us once again is his mother, Kathy McMenemy. Thanks for coming, Kathy.
Hello.
Okay, let's get to talking about some of these topics. That was the most fun introduction bit ever, so it's going to be hard to top. One of the things I wanted to touch on this week, we mentioned it just very briefly in one of our earlier episodes, is that the county fair, the Summit County Fair, is going to be going forward. A couple details about that. It's going to be one day shorter than it usually is. You know, like so many things that are opening in spite of, you know, the threat of the coronavirus, there's a lot of talk about, you know, sanitizer stations being set up throughout. And then they're doing some of the same things like we see like in grocery stores. They're going to have one-way traffic through the exhibits and stuff. I assume that means like if you want to look at the horses or whatever, you can only go one way through the stable. They call it a stable at the fair? I assume they do. Or if you're going through, you know, where they show off their giant zucchinis or whatever, then also you can only walk one way. And then also they're going to do regular sanitizing of surfaces. I assume that means like places where you might eat or where people might be touching surfaces. They're going to only be at half capacity in the grandstand, which apparently is 1,500. I don't know that I've been to the grandstand in the Summit County Fairgrounds because I had no idea it would hold 3,000 people. But apparently 1,500 is half capacity. They're going to reduce their spaces for vendors from 72 to 45. So, you know, you're going to get a few less local politician yardsticks this year. And then they have posted a warning message online just to sort of like educate people about the threat of the coronavirus. Now, last year there was some controversy about the county fair because there was a show in which they brought live tigers. And so I think there were a lot of people who were probably planning on not going to the fair anyway. But what do you guys think about the county fair moving forward, and maybe about county fairs in general?
I grew up in 4-H, so I know a lot about county fairs and participated in a lot of county fairs, and I had a good time. But I was reading the paper, and it said that there was going to be less restrictions than other county fairs. So I'm kind of concerned about that. And part of their disclaimer almost felt like a legal disclaimer. It said you voluntarily assume all risk related to exposure to COVID-19. So I don't know if that's for a service to the public or if that's just trying to cover their behind, that if somebody does get sick, that they can't come back to the fair and sue them. I know that it said in the paper that they were losing money and that it normally costs $100,000 to, if I'm remembering this number right, to run the fair, but it's going to cost, I think it said $125,000 this year with all the extra safety precautions and the loss of revenue that they're going to have with the vendors coming in. Fairs are not known to be the cleanest environments normally.
DeWine announced a few hours ago, that only junior fairs will be allowed on how after July 31st are doing away with all events where there's going to be spectators, and they're scaling them down there. And it's a big directive that just came down like a few hours ago.
Well, then that'll be interesting to see what Summit County does about that. They're going to have to probably change.
They are.
They did say that they did not have the fair this year, then they wouldn't know how they would financially recover from a loss of the year. So,
yeah, and the Summit County Fair is scheduled to start tomorrow. So I don't know if, like, the first couple days they're going to try and squeeze in the demolition derby and the tractor pull or what. But if that goes into effect July 31st, they've got, you know, the 29th and the 30th to do things. But it sounds like maybe they're going to have to change their approach here a little bit. Speaking of returning to school, there have been a couple developments there. Over the weekend, it was reported that Woodridge schools have had detailed their plan for returning to school. The school buildings apparently have had furniture optimized for COVID-19 issues, which I imagine just means they've moved around fixtures and things to make sure that people are able to social distance as best they can. Again, hand sanitizing stations placed. They're saying that the lower grades are going to attend 5 days per week, and the upper classes are just going to attend twice per week. And that when you're not in school, there will be online education to round that out. This is all very similar to the Cuyahoga Falls School District plan. Meanwhile, there have been some school districts, really just today, I think, who have announced, Akron Public Schools being one of them, that they are just going to go fully online, at least for the first semester this fall. Thoughts about returning to school?
Personally, my opinion is I'd either keep it distance learning or do the hybrid two on, two off and space it out. I'm not even sure what, like, the lower grades going back 5 days. I mean, the kids are still going to spread it just as much as teens and whatnot would. So I don't see what the point is of allowing them to go back. You know, I understand they need the social aspect of it and whatnot, but to send them back 5 days a week and put teachers at risk and then, you know, all the other staff at risk and then bring it home to possibly, you know, susceptible people, whatnot, you know, parents, grandparents, whatever. I just don't feel comfortable with it. That's just me. But I guess it would be harder to do an online instruction set with children, smaller children maybe, but I don't know. I think it's a little too soon. I'd rather just see all online for the first semester, let's say, you know, get through the fall, get through the winter, see if this thing does spike or not, or if we get closer to some kind of vaccination or a vaccine. and wait till next year, but that's just my opinion.
It just seems like there's no good way to go about it. And, you know, speaking of winter, I mean, you know, anymore, winter doesn't really start until January. At least that's how it feels to me. I mean, you know, you get by the time you get to Christmas, it's like maybe it snowed, but like it doesn't really start snowing until January, February. And then we get pummeled with it, you know. That's when it's going to be the coldest. That's when it's going to be when,
February.
Yeah, that's going to be when people are huddled in their houses with the heat on, which is going to make it easier for the disease to spread. And if we don't have a vaccine or widespread testing or any of those kinds of things, you know, we could be looking at we could be looking at going all the way up to next summer, being on lockdown. And that is not something people want to hear, you know.
Nobody wants it.
Right. Nobody wants it. And not to mention the fact that there are a lot of people who are still basically just ambivalent about the seriousness of it, you know. And just compounding that, again, are issues related to childcare for people who have jobs where they can't just take off. And kids who are on IEPs who need specialized instruction and therapies and things like that. And, of course, that is the category we fall into in my house, because one of my daughters does need some therapies and stuff as part of an IEP. So it's just so complicated. I think the school district is, you know, damned if they do, damned if they don't. But it sounds like Woodridge is going much the same direction as Cuyahoga Falls. Other thoughts about school districts? Or, Mike, did you have something else to add?
I was going to say, to your point on the daycare, I thought I heard that DeWine has given daycares the okay to start operation again back on August 11th.
I mean, yeah,
it's like, what do you do? I mean, it's like, I get parents need to go back to work, kids need to go back to school, you know, but at what cost?
Well, and speaking of cost, in one of our earlier episodes, Patrick made the point that so much of this is being decided by, you know, questions of money, questions of the economy, versus questions of health and safety. And I think that's just really so true. But it's still just really difficult for parents out there. I mean, short of, you know, adopting the Andrew Yang model of, you know, giving everybody $1,000 a month or just covering everybody's salary, it just seems like it's going to be really difficult to keep everybody happy while also keeping everybody home. So in our community, we have not seen a huge amount of infections and deaths. I think Summit County's somewhere around 2,500 confirmed cases, and something like, if I remember right, it was like maybe a couple hundred deaths. Maybe not even that many. Maybe one of you guys can look that up while we're talking here. At Market District in Portage Crossing there, at Portage Trail and State Road, there was a worker who tested positive for COVID-19. And it was reported by Market District because they actually had like a tracker that was going on their website for a while, where if one of their workers was found to have, you know, had the disease, they would sort of like put it out there so that everybody would know, and kind of like, you know, for their own edification and their own safety and stuff. They have since taken that tracker down. There was a couple of different reasons given, but it sort of seemed like it was just maybe bad PR, frankly. What we do know is that the individual who tested positive for COVID-19 at Market District in our community had their last day of work on July 16th, which is, you know, a while ago now. So you would think that they would hopefully be over the symptoms by now, or that they stopped working because they knew they were positive and, you know, wanted to keep people safe. So hopefully we haven't seen any other positive tests from employees or customers since then. But if there have been, I'm sure, you know, we're going to find out about it soon. Which kind of brings up the question of, like, you know, knowing people who have been tested. So what do you guys think about this this individual at Market District who's tested positive? And do you guys have people in your networks who have come up with the disease?
I'm definitely paranoid because I went to Market District the next day. And it was like, okay, maybe, you know, they cleaned everything by then.
Yeah, it's a small store.
But I definitely, it's worrisome.
I'm not particularly concerned about it. And next day, I think most of transmission they've found, it doesn't actually happen from touching surfaces, particularly after it's 24 hours have passed. Most of it's from just breath, being in close proximity with somebody in a closed area. That's what causes most of the transmissions. I think that safety wise, that's probably pretty low risk to go in even the next day, even if no one even knew that they had it. This particular case, I heard it was in the pharmacy. It was a pharmacy worker. So, and they, since they found out, they cleaned everything and everyone went, sent home and all the necessary precautions. So,
as of yesterday, in Summit County, we had 2,951 confirmed cases, 214 deaths. Personally, I know at my place of employment, I know one person that's been tested. We're waiting results on that. So he's been taking a vacation, and we possibly have another individual that has been taking a test or has taken a test. So we're waiting to hear results on that, too. So we'll see what happens.
Well, that's going to start becoming common. I mean, you're going to just start hearing that more and more. It's not going to be surprising anymore. I would be surprised in maybe another month or two if there's anybody that doesn't know somebody who has been tested positive.
That was my thing kind of from the beginning of all this. It seemed to me that it wasn't going to feel real for most people until everybody knew somebody who'd had it. And in our county, that just doesn't seem all that likely. I know there's a hell of a lot more than 3,000 people in this county. And that's, you know, so, but I do know one person. I was involved with an event over the weekend, and somebody sent me a message and said they couldn't come because they were quarantining because it looked like their partner had it. And they wanted to be sure. I haven't heard back whether or not that person actually had it or not. But otherwise, I haven't known anybody personally who had it. But I've like known people who knew people, you know, who had it. And it's usually not anybody like, oh, my wife had it. It's like, it's more like, you know, just like an acquaintance. So it's like, it doesn't usually like travel that fast. As you guys know, I've been working on a new album of my music. And I have to travel to Youngstown to do that. And when I was there recently, the engineer there told me a story about somebody who had been in his studio who had it, but he didn't have it at that time. Like, he found out he had it later, and the band that he was a part of, like, just didn't come back for, I think, like a month, and then everybody was fine. So, you know, that's the closest it's come to me. Anybody else?
I wanted to mention quickly that my wife, since she works at the clinic, main campus in Cleveland, they've just been given a directive that's saying that anyone that works with patients needs to wear a face shield as well as a surgical mask when they see any patients whatsoever. And that's a new directive. And also, workers are no longer allowed to wear homemade masks. They're all going to be issued surgical masks. They also stopped reporting. They used to have a COVID report that used to give to all their employees. They was available to all the managers, and they would disseminate that information to everyone. And now they stop reporting all of that to anyone. All those numbers are now being kept close to the vest, so to say.
It's the same thing that happened with Market District. Yeah. So that's worrisome. You know, when the people who were trying to be transparent about the information are now stopping that transparency, that's troublesome.
I had some coworkers who had an aunt die from it. And I've heard a cooker say something like, yeah, when it first started, like, I didn't know what to think, but now I know it's real. It's like, well, you should have just taken it seriously when it started, you know? So I don't know. It seems like it's getting like, it's like, it's closing in on our circles, like our coworkers and stuff. Like, we're starting to know people that get tested.
Yeah. Can we talk briefly about masking? Because I know we've all got probably more stories about that since the last time we talked. Go ahead. Anybody who's got one, Mike, look like you're ready for that.
Wear your fucking mask.
There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Sorry, I had to say it.
So I was at Sheets up on Steele's Corner on Sunday night, and I walked in, and there were five men in like the dining area, you know, presumably waiting on food. None of them wearing masks. I was actually just picking up an order, which was all ready for me to go, so I could just walk in, grab it, paid for it, and all that, you know. Walked in, picked it up, and there was a store employee right there by the shelf where I went to pick it up. And I grabbed my bag, looked at her, and said, five people not wearing masks, and then turned around and left. So I'm sure I left and she said, what a jerk. But I mean, you know, those people should have been wearing masks. And so I wasn't trying to be rude to her, but I also understand, and we've had this conversation on the Fallscast here, you know, that there are people in charge of enforcing these rules who are going to be sometimes oblivious, and maybe even scared, you know, to enforce, or, you know, they just don't want to deal with it. Or they might themselves be skeptics. Or anti-maskers or whatever. So, you know, I guess that's the one thing I've sort of dealt with as far as no masks. I went to the gas station on my street and I saw a guy go in. He got out of his car and he made a big show of putting his T-shirt up over his nose. Now, I don't know if he was doing that. Maybe he forgot his mask and he genuinely wanted a mask. And so he did that, you know, instead. But it could also just have been that he was like, oh, this is stupid. Okay, I'll put my shirt up so nobody says anything. But I'm not even sure anybody would have said anything, you know. So.
Well, we were grocery shopping just last night, and it was at an establishment that requires you to wear masks. And I remember going down a couple of the aisles, and a good amount of people had the masks pulled down below their nose. And I saw a couple of individuals that just had the mask pulled all the way down to their neck, you know, so just walking around. Or we even went to a local consignment thrift shop, you know, kind of thing. And there was one, the lady running the register, no mask at all, and was talking to everybody about, you kind of overhear her talking about, well, you know, if you have a strong immune system, and then starting to go into conspiracy theories about, you know, why they want you to wear masks and why they don't want you to wear masks and all this stuff. And I'm just like, okay, I don't think we should be shopping here, but... that's all we've really run into.
But I love that place. That was hard to hear.
Yes, that was. I was like, oh my, everybody else there, like all the other employees.
That was kind of disturbing to see the owner talking about that.
It does seem like some businesses, you're like seeing the true colors of some of the businesses based on this mandate. Like there was a business in Kent, a bakery, a very, like a beloved bakery in Kent that was in trouble because they had put up a sign that said, you know, we're not going to wear it. This was before the mandate. The most recent mandate, but they had a sign up that said, you know, we're not going to wear masks and all this kind of stuff.
Yes. Yeah, so we also went to a local business, and the owner was talking as we were just talking about it. And she was like, yeah, I just don't know who to believe. And just kind of saying stuff. And it's like, oh, come on already. It's like, just believe scientists. It's like, it's common sense.
It's also not difficult. You know, it's just not a hard thing to wear a mask. It's really not.
I've gotten into a bunch of Facebook arguments lately with someone commenting on posts that a nurse is posting. Someone who actually works for a hospital. And he's like, oh no, the kids aren't going to get sick and the teachers aren't going to get sick. It's all a hoax. And it's like, you are literally talking to a nurse.
Yeah. But my Facebook friend who does all kinds of research says that it's a hoax. Let's not believe the scientist part.
Yeah, I mean, my wife got in an argument recently with someone about clinical research. I mean, and she's a clinical researcher. That's what she does for a living. And they're trying to tell her how research works and that why this is fake and this is fake. And they literally didn't want to hear anything they had to say. Come on. I mean, that's what she literally does for a living. She understands research. Well,
okay, so the next thing is that there was a resolution that was adopted by Cuyahoga Falls City School District Board of Education. Basically, some of the, you know, the high level things that are supposed to happen include they have to form this diversity and equity committee that reports to the board and makes recommendations to the superintendent. They have to develop a district racial equity policy. They have to analyze the district's curriculum with attention to diversity and the contribution of Indigenous peoples. They're going to prepare an annual report of racial bias complaints and the outcomes of those complaints. And then they're going to incorporate public health effects of racism into their student wellness plan. They also have to expand diversity, equity, and inclusion and implicit bias training for staff. So those are all things. Let me clarify that. They have to expand diversity, equity, and inclusion as well as implicit bias training for the staff. And then they affirmed that Black Lives Matter. And that was part of the language of the resolution. So, where are we at on this? What do we think of this?
It's a great first step. And I think even Anthony said that it was a first step. And it's a long time coming to even acknowledge that there is an issue and there is an innate bias in education against people of color, I think was pretty pretty powerful to have not only the school board supporting, but the superintendent supporting it. I think that was pretty powerful to have the superintendent also participate in writing this up. So
a lot of people's questions that were posted online about this particular vote at the Board of Education, they were concerned this is going to cost money and take away from the monies that were available for to educate their children. I wanted to see if you could discuss that quickly.
I didn't think it was going to cost any money.
That was my understanding of it too.
Right.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything about that. I mean, you can have a committee and not.
Yeah, committee doesn't cost people. Anything. You just basically it's a meeting and you're talking about stuff and
pretty much.
I mean, you can argue that this is taken away from other things that they could be talking about or that they could be doing. But I mean, I don't think that there's going to be any money earmarked for this resolution.
I thought it was a silly, weak argument against it. I mean, they're just trying to come up with anything they can to say that we shouldn't do it.
Right. Well, and along that, some of those comments were that, you know, why do we want to create a new committee when our schools are failing? Or, you know,
correct.
But that's the same argument of why should we build a new
building? It's a silly argument. I mean, you can do three things at once. It's not one or the other.
Exactly.
And that's a silly argument
against
anything.
Most people can. Most people can do multiple things at once.
And even in the resolution itself, it states that, you know, Black students continue to trail white students in test scores. Reading is 90% for white students and 74.5% for Black students. Math is 86.7 versus 65%.
Is that our district or is that all districts?
I'm assuming that's in the resolution that was drafted by us. So I'm assuming that's just in our district. I don't have the state or national numbers for that.
I know national numbers, that sounds about right, but I was wondering if they track that locally at our district.
I'm assuming since it's ours, I would assume that it's ours, but even in here, 4% of our students are English language learners. So, you know, those people that are still learning our language are going to have more difficulties. So
yeah, Bhutanese Nepalese and Nepalese. They're all going to have pressures. And a lot of them are in our elementary schools right now.
Yeah.
Well, and so much of a student's performance in public school is going to depend on the situation at home as well. And that always going to be compounded by poverty if that's what the student's living through. And of course, people of color in this country, certainly experience poverty at a much higher level or a much higher percentage than white people. And that's certainly true in our community too. So if you're struggling with your educational goals, there's a good chance that it has something to do with the situation at home. It seems to me that this resolution helps combat that problem, but that the opponents of it are opponents of it for political reasons. And not necessarily interested in, you know, the perks the good outcomes that may come from it.
It's sad that this has to become a political issue.
Well, everything does now, you know, everything
that,
does.
Yeah, it's true. Everything, everything does, well, but.
To that, it's even sad that we have to have a resolution to bring this to the forefront. You know, I mean, to be making resolutions like this to discuss this and acknowledge it, or just acknowledge that there's any racism still here in today's day and age, is it's sad. You know, these are things that we shouldn't have to make a resolution for. You know, these things that, you know, we should just be doing, but we're not. You know, we look the other way, you know.
My guess is David Martin would say that his choice to abstain from the vote was because it's political. But the sort of ironic thing about that is his abstaining from the vote makes it political as well, right? It is a political decision on his part to not vote for this, because the content of the resolution does nothing if not improve education for all students. I mean, because it's not just going to help uplift, you know, students of color in the district, but it's also going to improve the curriculum. For instance, that bit about making sure that they, you know, consider indigenous peoples in the curriculum. I mean, you know, it was kind of a joke for people in our generation, you know, that when we grew up, we heard the real story about Christopher Columbus, right? We heard the real story about indigenous yes. peoples in North America. But in school, you know, I mean, our textbook's still called them Indians, you know? So, you know, I get that for people who have more conservative politics, this all seems political, but if all they do is read the headline, which to look at some of the Facebook comments in response to our having posted the article that you guys wrote, you know, it seems like they didn't read the content of our article nor of the resolution itself, but that the headline itself was enough to sort of throw them into a fit about, you know, politics and whatever with regard to Black Lives Matter and all that.
I was going to say the one line in there that I could see people having a problem with, and maybe Mr. Martin had a problem with that, was that they affirm Black Lives Matters. That's the only line that I think a lot of people are going to see, and a lot of people have a problem with the Black Lives Matter group and or movement, and they're going to see that and say, well, we're getting on board with that, and, you know, it's a terrorist group and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's not what it's saying. I mean, it's, they affirm that Black people are people too, you know, indigenous people are indigenous, you know, they're people also, you know, Bhutanese and Nepalese, they're people too, you know, some of them may have a little different concerns or different needs because they're learning a second language. You know, people want to make fun of these people, but yet you're learning a second language. Some people may know three languages, you know, and we can sit here and say that, oh, we're the greatest country in the world, but we had the luxury of not needing to learn two or three different languages. You know, if we went somewhere else, you know, we'd be made fun of because we don't understand their language, and we'd be the idiots or we'd be the stupid ones or this or that. But, you know, a lot of other countries still accommodate us with learning English. They still want to converse with us. We don't do that here, you know, and it's just frustrating.
No, I can barely speak one language, let alone two languages. So
my English are gooder.
Yeah.
I have a little theory about why some people have such a hard time with the Black Lives Matter, the whole set, that whole, even this whole movement. To admit there's a problem, that means they have to admit to themselves they have a problem and they're part of the problem. And some people don't want to realize or think about themselves as being potentially racist in any way, because racist is such a terrible, dirty word. And I'm not a racist, because when they think of racism, they think of a man in a white hat. You know, they think the worst. But racism is a scale, like anything. You know, it's to zero to 100, and some, we all fall somewhere on that scale because of our upbringing and our what we've been exposed to and society and culture and everything. And to deny that it's a problem means it's easier on your own psyche. It's, you don't have to admit that you're part of the problem or you have to deal with it. It's much easier emotionally.
I agree with Steve. And along that line, I think people are immediately defensive with the subject. And instead of, like you said, addressing that there's a scale of racism, you know, no one likes to be called a racist. So as soon as they hear the subject, they think you're calling them racist. So their first instinct is to be defensive. And it'd be nice if people could not be defensive, get past that piece, to even read about some things and learn about biases and things. Just get information about it. And they don't have to. It's not like they have to be taken out in public and say, oh my gosh, I'm a racist. They don't even have to admit that publicly. As long as they learn and change internally how they are, and change how they act, then it's progress. It's almost like people are afraid that they're suddenly going to be exposed as being racist when you just want them to learn what it means.
Right. Well, I think that falls along, is it called cognitive dissonance? As soon as somebody questions you on your belief or your idea, you immediately take personal offense to it. So you bristle up and, you know, you're going to fight back. And if you take a step back and realize that person's not attacking you or your idea or school board's idea or whatnot, then you can have the discussion. You can start the discussion. You know, and that's where we can start talking about race, you know, and racial relations and whatnot. And we can realize there's cultural differences, but that's okay. You know, it doesn't make anyone better than anyone else.
Oh, gosh, we're all guilty of that, though, right? I mean, anytime somebody wants to attack or even question our idea, we're going to bristle up. So it's very difficult to change. It's very difficult to admit that you might be wrong on something, or you said something that's offensive, or you did something that was offensive. I mean, nobody, well, I wouldn't say nobody, but most people don't want to think of themselves as racist. Right. Or have bias, you know, tendencies. But, you know, we all do. I grew up in a city that had absolutely no other race other than white. I think we had one black student that came in the school in my high school year, and that was a big deal. And so when I moved and came into more of a diverse city, not that, you know, Cuyahoga Falls is a, you know, metropolis, but there was definitely a lot more diversity than what I grew up with. I had to acknowledge that I would do things or say things without even knowing that I would do it. And I still do it. I mean, I get called out my children call me out on it all the time and call it my old fashioned way of thinking. Not that I'm trying to be hurtful or trying to, you know, be bigoted. It's just, I just don't know. I mean, I'm ignorant with a lot of those things because of the way that I was, you know, was brought up. Not, you know, I wasn't brought up to be mean. I didn't think of anybody with a different race or religion or creed or anything like that as worse or better than myself, but I just wasn't around it. So we all kind of have to put away our pride a little bit and, you know, be open to this discussion and realize that every single one of us has bias.
So this is one of those things where, like, because there's people, I think there's still people that don't, they think it makes them uncomfortable, so they don't want to talk about it. It's like, oh my God, don't talk about that. It's going to make me uncomfortable. It's like, well, if you don't start talking about it, it's not going to go away. It's one of those things where you need to start talking about it, no matter how hard it is.
Yeah, it's going to get less comfortable the longer we ignore it.
Well, listening to something the other day, they were talking about how racism is more of a systemic thing than, you know, being prejudicial and blah, blah, blah. But some of these racist ideas, we don't even acknowledge or notice. Obviously, in the computer world or videographer world, you have master slave. They used to call, you know, this was the master drive, this was the slave drive. Well, we've started to change that to primary and secondary or client server. But the old grandfather clause, people were grandfathered into stuff. That's a racist, it has racist origins. Master bedroom, you know, there were certain things that we deal with that we never even thought about, you know, that are racist or had racist origins. And to start really, you know, breaking it down and looking at what even our language or society has become because of these terms and whatnot, that exposes a lot of, you know, prejudicial and or just racial bias that we need to have the discussion about. Uncomfortable as it may be, we need to have that discussion.
Well, and there are voices that are shouting now, and that's the thing that's making people uncomfortable, is that, you know, we've reached this point where people are literally dying, and those people from that community are going, enough, you know, and they're speaking out, they're yelling, they're getting mad, and, you know, all the people who, you know, are having a hard time admitting that they have been a part of the problem, and that includes myself, and I think we would all admit to some extent, you know, we have been in that role also. But the institution, right? The institutionalization of racism has led to this point, right? And I think that it's no wonder that it's gotten to be so serious at this point. But I think the outcome is going to be that, you know, we are finally able to kind of take a harder look at ourselves and move forward. Now, that's not going to be the case for everybody. You know, my parents' generation, my father was born in 1949. My mother was born in 1954. My father has never exhibited any behaviors to me that I felt like, whoa, that's a little racist, you know. But my mother has said things sometimes, and I always call her on it, and she always sort of clams up, you know, she just gets like, she tightens up at first, and then I talk to her about it, and she loosens back up, she understands, and she moves forward. But not everybody can do that, you know, especially people who, you know, hold particular beliefs that are not just deep-seated, but that are sort of intentional. But what we also know is that just things take time in our society. Barack Obama was against gay marriage. You know? I mean, it just takes time. And a seed has been planted that has sprouted and flowered at this moment. But like, you know, the leaves are going to fall off and the tree will still be there. And each season it'll get a little bigger. I mean, this is a dumb analogy, but you understand what I mean. Like, our conversation in our society about racism is going to continue, but we are going to be stronger for it. And we will begin to accept, you know, that we need to move forward, that we are part of the problem, and that we can be better. You know what I mean? I think it's interesting that we're having this conversation sort of more generally about racism in this context, because, you know, our conversation last week in our podcast was difficult for a lot of us because of the issue with the blackface. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have Dr. Akbar on, who's going to talk to us after our roundtable discussion here. And so we'll leave some of that for him. But I mean, you know, that question of blackface is one of many sort of sub issues within, or I guess we could say under the umbrella of racism. And that was one where we in our group were uncomfortable in the moment having that conversation for our listeners to hear. And as much as I sort of realized as we were having the conversation and after, and when we got together and we're talking about that episode of the Falls Cast, I still feel that it was an appropriate thing to have out there. Because I think that we all grew a little bit because of that conversation. And I'm really interested to hear what Dr. Akbar has to say. So
I think the conversation we had last week was extremely uncomfortable. I listened to our fall cast and heard myself struggling with trying to, you know what to say. And what struck me as, I think for a lot of us, our initial thought was, why did he keep it up there? And I think you and I were talking about that, Alex, it wasn't like, why did he do it in the first place? Our first thought was like, why didn't you delete the picture? And looking back and hearing myself say that, that's embarrassing. I can't believe that that would be my initial thought. But I think I grew from that. And it did get me thinking, like, no, you know, why did he do it in the first place? I mean, we can make justifications for it. And, oh, it was, you know, 12 years ago, or it was this, you know, many years ago. But wrong is wrong, no matter when it was, and whether or not it was
acceptable in our society or not.
There was some question about intent, you know, also. And again, these are things I want to talk to Dr. Akbar about. I'll tell you, Suzanne, the one thing that keeps kind of popping back up in my imagination is Kaylee getting angry at you in the conversation right. that you guys had. And honestly, when we had Sunny Matthews on, one of the things she said in her speech that we covered was, I keep seeing white people bringing their babies to these protests. And she said, that's power. And I think that's just such a good way to sort of make that point. And that is that, you know, people Patrick's age, and maybe you can speak to this, Patrick, and younger, are being raised in a way that they're developing a fundamentally different sense of what constitutes racism and a keener eye for detecting it, right? And man, I'll tell you what, that's going to be frustrating for old people, because if a 20-year-old Patrick tells a 60 or 70-year-old white man that he's doing something racist,
or 40-year-old woman.
I mean, you know, it's not always going to be, oh, you're right, thanks, you know. Go ahead, Patrick and Kathy. I know you want to respond to that.
So after that, when it comes to Patrick, is that, I mean, I try to raise him that way, to be open and nice and, you know, not mean. But there's things that he's taught me a lot, too, to where I have said some things and he's corrected me and, you know, on things that were racist, like, well, that's kind of racist. And then he would, like, call me out on it and made me rethink. And we had conversations about privilege.
Yeah.
White privilege. I mean, this was a couple years ago. And it was very interesting conversations we had.
Yeah.
And he was telling me what was wrong with something that I was thinking. And it made me rethink, you know, stuff. And
I actually remember a few years ago, back, like, when there was, like, all the stuff, like, the unpacking stuff, we would be like, well, what do you mean? Like we had a hard life too. It, like, it's kind of like, you do get defensive.
Yeah.
It's easy to get defensive, you know, because you think,
like,
what?
And that's part of it too, is that I understand some people's anger towards that, because I used to feel the same way of, you know, knowing poor white people and think, well, they're not privileged. It's, I mean, I understand that argument because I've seen it, you know, myself, and I used to think the same way. And it was learning that really is not the same thing. It's to separate that and to not be defensive and look at it from a different point of view. And it's things that Patrick has taught me, not that I taught him that. It's just things he's figured out.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Bart?
Well, I used to have a coworker at a job that she would constantly say horrible things about people of other races, people of differing political views as herself. She would constantly yell things with all those people protesting and, you know, all those liberals. And it's like, you're in a room full of all those people, for one. And again, and would say things like, you know, well, I'm not racist, I have a black grandchild. I called her out several times, and she would yell at me like, your parents didn't raise you right if you're saying that to me. And it's like, no, my parents raised me pretty good if I'm saying that to you.
Yeah. Something else that's interesting, too, is just how it permeates so many other things. Like, I was thinking about The Boondock Saints, which is a movie that I used to just, like, love. I'm still a big fan of that movie. But there is one scene in particular that where some characters tell, like, a particularly racist joke, and they actually emphasize the racist language. And these are not characters you're supposed to like. But I can imagine, you know, like, younger audiences seeing, you know, films and things that we enjoyed that were even just from, like, the 80s or 90s, you know, that by today's standards, for somebody like Patrick or younger, sorry to keep singling you out, Patrick. I think we all have at least 20 years on you, though. So for somebody like Patrick's age or younger to see a movie even from, like, the 1990s, they might be like, oh, that's a little bit racist, you know. And you kind of have to be able to, like, you know, have that intellectual ability to separate yourself from, you know, the racist things that you find in media and culture, But sometimes that's difficult to do, and it just really depends. It's like the point Patrick was making last week about the YouTube star who was wearing blackface and doing racially insensitive things, and and all the way up to HBO Max pulling what was it?
Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind, yeah. So one other thing, just, you know, we talked in one of our last episodes here about the library levy. Again, it's a levy that would generate $1.374 million per year, and it represents half the library's revenues. So the school district had to vote to determine whether or not they were going to put that on the ballot. They did vote to put it on the ballot, so that's going to move forward. Also, we just wanted at the Falls Cast to shout out to Andrew Lewis, our friend who owns Black Metal Strength Training. Andrew moved his business from Portage Trail to State Road, and he has written a couple articles for us, and we have another one coming up pretty soon that's all about sort of new gym anxiety. So that's going to be coming out really soon here on falsefreepress.com. And he's got other stuff too. If you visit his website, he's got a lot of articles that are up there already. He told me he was writing one article about different kinds of alloys used to make bars for barbell, you know, weight bars, I guess is the term, weight bars. He's going real deep when it comes to thinking about fitness and all that stuff. And I highly recommend anybody interested in starting some kind of fitness plan, reach out to Andrew Lewis at Black Metal Strength Training. That's not an ad. That's just good advice. And then I also want to mention that we have a couple new articles up on falsefreepress.com. One of them, our friend here, Bart, wrote for us about the series Close Enough.
It's one of the few new shows so far that I have found on HBO Max that at least drawn my attention.
Oh, you're the one that subscribes to HBO Max.
Yeah, not for much longer.
Hey, so do we. We do too.
Is it? How many of you are still on a free trial?
that's offensive.
Maybe one or two more free trials.
Yeah, we had HBO Now when Game of Thrones was out, and that was about it. And we just never haven't canceled it.
Yeah, I have HBO through Amazon Prime, so I don't know what difference it would make for me to have Max. Like, I don't want to watch The Big Bang Theory, so, you know. I guess
if you have it, you might actually have HBO Max right now.
Yeah, you might got upgraded.
Oh, and the reason we called Bart Swifty at the beginning of our podcast today is because Mike alerted us that the word Swifty is something that means you're a Taylor Swift fan.
I guess, I don't know.
Oh, see, making stuff up.
Yes, Mike, you were correct.
Oh, was I? Holy
I just looked it up.
Why did you tell him that? Now he's gonna get a big head.
Can't get much bigger.
So Bart, is the new album good? And I'm asking you that, even though I've never listened to a single Taylor Swift album, although I have heard some songs like Trouble, I think.
Well, read my article and edit it, and then when it comes back, it'll go online and everyone will know.
There you go.
And because I have to edit it, I will know too.
I probably won't read that, Bart. No offense.
Aw, I'll read it, Bart.
So, a couple of arts things. Yesterday, I drove up to, I drove downtown with my family. We checked out all the murals, which are all still up. There's a mural on the side of the building where Cuyahoga Valley Arts Center is. And then opposite that wall on the Portage Trail Bridge, there's another mural that just went up from Nikki Bartel, which is really kind of a cool one. Also, that's the newest one. It just went up, I think, Saturday. And they also have the Fun Flows Here mural between Vivo and Clean Eats down there on the other end of Front Street. So everybody should check those out. There's more murals to come. I think there's like three more that are going to go up. One of them is going to be on Flurries, which I love that there's going to be one right there because all these murals.
They're very visible.
Yeah, exactly. All these murals that have gone up, it's like, that's cool there are murals there, but when there's one right there on Flurries, you know, it's going to, I think it's really going to make an impact. So
When I first saw the one on the side of the Cuyahoga Valley Art Center, I'm like, why did he put it there? Because they put it right down in front of like three parking spaces. Everyone parks it and you can't even see it. I had a heck of a time even getting a photograph of it. I had to use an ultra wide angle lens because there's cars parked like, you know, 2 feet from the wall and you can't see it unless you literally walk right up on it. So if you would have put it higher, like on a ladder and then got a ladder and done it, then it would have been much more visible because that was a giant wall. Just got to put it like 5 or 6 foot higher and then everyone would have loved it. I thought it was a cool mural. I really liked it, but nobody can enjoy it because unless you walk right up next to it. Well, whatever. That's my complaint as an artist saying a
lot. Well, my sense too is that, like, you know, you have this huge canvas on the side of that building, like, and they used a teeny tiny little piece of it.
Yeah.
I would love to see if they're going to do public art in the city, you know, take that whole side of that building and do something cool with it. Something bright, you know, something that's going to, like, you know, catch people's eye, like, even when they're...
I would amazing if they had a permanent one, a large permanent one, and, you know, or do, a section every year, change it and add to it.
Like the one that used to be where the pavilion is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's... The one that before they put the building up now, and then on the side of the Studio 2091. Yeah, there used to be a mural there for years.
Yeah. Well, the Public Arts Master Plan was initiated, I think, because... they do want to have some more permanent public art downtown and around the city. So, you know, my understanding too is that the Chalk It Up thing that they're doing now is to kind of like break the idea in amongst residents. So, you know, we will see permanent public art downtown. It's just a matter of time. Deciding what's going to appeal to people and 'cause, you know, it's going to be controversial, whatever they decide to put up, you know,
whatever. I mean, you know, that's any art, you know, there's...
Yeah, well, there's a video that people can check out on Instagram. I think it's also on Facebook, of Nikki Bartel putting her mural up and kind of explaining what it means to her. And Bart, I think, posted about that in a Facebook post that you put up with the pictures that Steven took today. So, you know, facebook.com/FallsFreePress. You can check out those pictures that Steven took. And our little blurb about it. And maybe we can link that video of her describing what it means in the comments to that or something so that people can check that out. And then just a quick shameless self-promotion here. I'm going to be playing with the Moderns and my string band Summit Sky at the Tiki Underground on August 1st. I maybe wouldn't have self-promoted here if it weren't for the fact that the coronavirus is happening and it's been very difficult to find opportunities to see live music. But the Tiki Underground, which is right there at the corner of... whatever state road is when it, I think it's Akron Cleveland Road. When you get all the
Akron,
way up by,
Cleveland Road.
Yeah,
it's 303 and I think it's 303 and State Roads Hudson.
Akron,
yeah. Akron Cleveland and 303. So right where that corner is, Tiki Underground's right there. What they're doing is they're having bands perform outside facing Akron Cleveland Road, and people are bringing lawn chairs and stuff and setting up right there. In the grass, so it's so you know you can be socially distant. Tiki Underground has food and drinks and stuff, and I'm going to be performing with two bands that night, so I'm going to be running double duty. But if you're starved for an opportunity for live music, I hope you'll come out on August 1st and check that out. So yeah, that brings us to the end of this week's Fallscast. Please stay tuned for our interview with Dr. NJ Akbar, the host of Perspectives with Black Men, and he's going to talk to us about our conversation about the Cuyahoga Falls officer in blackface last week. So stay tuned for that right after our discussion. Thank you guys so much for talking with us this afternoon. Everybody have a good week.
Thank you. Bye.
Later.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're here with Akron Public School Board member Dr. NJ Akbar, also dean at Kent State University. What specifically are you a dean of?
I am the assistant dean for academic diversity in University College. And so we're the student success hub of the institution. And my role is to specifically around the strategic success of our students who are first in their families to go to college, who are from limited income backgrounds and are eligible, as well as students who are African-American, Latino-American, or Latinx, or Indigenous or Native American, and they come to campus. And we also have been working to do more work around supporting multiracial students as well. So,
awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the Fallscast today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate being able to be here.
Cool. So you don't live in Cuyahoga Falls, obviously. You're a member of the Akron Public School Board. But you have had a little bit of influence here actually just recently, as far as helping our school board member, Anthony Gomez here, who's the vice president of our board, work on this resolution to combat racism. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Yeah, so partially. So in my role as vice president of the Akron Board of Education, I also chair or co-chair, I should say, the Policy and Legal Contracts Committee. And I thought it was important that we reexamine our equity policy and that we actually specifically make a racial equity policy. Well, in addition to that, there's been a lot going on in the country around race and equity, and specifically police brutality, that has illuminated some racial tensions, and as well as the existence of racism and structural racism within all the systems that we have in our country. And so I use that momentum as a way of bringing forth our racism as a public health crisis that adversely affects or impacts our students, our staff, our families, and the community at large. And one of the roles that I wanted to play is be able to consult and help other districts do the same, and not just pass simple, statements of condemnation and say we condemn racism, because that's been done far too many times before. That has not led to any type of change. And so I wanted to be able to lead substantive changes with substantive actions that boards can take on, and leaders on boards can begin to start those conversations.
Yeah, and specifically some of those changes. Well, actually, can you talk about how you got sort of in contact with Anthony Gomez? Did he reach out to you? How did that all come about?
Well, one, Anthony is a friend of mine. And so we talk, at least regularly enough to where we know what's going on with each other. When we passed our resolution on racism, we were the first in the nation to do so. And it was very public, publicly known. As well as he and I have been talking already about, because I am an equity expert and professional, that's what I do daily. We had been talking about some things that he wanted to do with the district. And then when this came up, it just highlighted that conversation that we were having. I did a presentation for the Ohio School Board Association on ways in which boards can lead those conversations. And after that presentation, Anthony and I had a conversation about what he wanted to do with Cuyahoga Falls.
Yeah, and he's actually been instrumental in doing certain things here in the Falls, too. When the Falls Free Press, which is sort of the parent media company of the Fallscast here, first got started about 2.5 years ago, he was one of the first people we spoke to on a podcast, and it was because he had invited Equality Ohio to come and speak before the board, and as a result of that, they had developed new policy to protect all students and faculty. So we're real pleased with him and the impact he's had on our board here in Cuyahoga Falls. Specifically, some of the stuff that was in the resolution that was put forth here in Cuyahoga Falls with your help was that there was going to be an equity committee that would report to the superintendent. the development of a racial equity policy, an analysis of the district's curriculum, and that would also pay attention to diversity and indigenous peoples as well. You know, an annual report on racial bias complaints and the outcomes of those complaints. They want to incorporate the public health effects of racism into their student wellness plan. And also, they have now a mandate to expand diversity, equity, inclusion, and implicit bias training for their staff. And then an affirmation that Black Lives Matter. So that was a lot of the sort of actionable items that are in the resolution. Is that pretty consistent with what you all did in Akron?
Well, we took 9 different actions. And so I think that for each board, this is what I shared in the presentation I did for all of Ohio school boards, but then also when I have conversations individually, and I've consulted with about 11 or 12 districts at this point, and about 3 or 4 of them have been outside of Ohio, and they have already passed, all but one, I think, has already passed their resolutions. But what I share is, you know, what we put together here in Akron was a baseline for how we can accelerate our conversation and actions around dismantling racism. Once we acknowledge that racism is a thing and it's a crisis that impacts all those we are afforded to have in our care, which includes our community, our family, and our staff members, not just our students, but definitely our students. And so we have to tailor it to those districts. And so I think Anthony did what he was supposed to do and work with your board. Some things won't get passed. You know, if you have one certain thing in there, you may not get it passed. So for example, you know, one of the things I thought was very important was that we denounced the teaching of Christopher Columbus founding this country. And, you know, through conversations, I realized that that might not have passed, nor would that have helped us with what we were doing because of that issue being divisive. And so what was more important to me that we do a better job of celebrating Indigenous people and their contributions to, you know, cultivating this land and acknowledging that the land that we live on every day, that we have the privilege to educate our students on every day, is sacred land and come from people who, cultivated it. And so I wanted to make sure that we do a good job of honoring their history and their lives as well.
Yeah, it seems to me like adding the point about Indigenous peoples being recognized in the sense of making sure that there's an inclusion of diversity in the curriculum is at least a way to move toward being able to do that kind of a denouncement of Columbus. I was joking in our conversation. Well, not joking. In our conversation for the Falls Cast this week, that it for the longest time was kind of like this dirty little secret that, I mean, I was born in 1980. I graduated high school in 1998. You know, and in our textbooks, Native Americans were still referred to as Indians. And it wasn't until you got to college that you really, you know, learned the real truth about Christopher Columbus and what he did. And as a literature major, reading early American literature in survey courses, you know, it was really pretty appalling to find that out after all these years of schooling, you know.
Right, right.
So.
Definitely, and I was a literature major in history and literature for secondary ed and undergrad as well.
Yeah, it's those things, they do come up in those courses for sure, because all you have to do is read the contemporaneous texts of yep. Columbus and those around him to see what was really happening. So, awesome. So, well, thank you so much, by the way, for your contributions to this resolution in our community. We're very fortunate that the resolution was adopted. We did have one member of our board who abstained without comment. We've reached out to him to try and get him to explain himself. He's not done so. I don't think he said anything to anybody, but you know.
Yeah, I saw that, and you know, because I'm not a Cuyahoga Falls resident nor a school board member there, I think I can get away with saying this. Also because I'm an equity expert, right? And so part of what we see is there's the need to coddle and to make comfortable individuals when we start having the conversation around race and racism. And some individuals don't understand that when we have these conversations about what's happening in reality, that we are going to need to stretch ourselves, and we're going to need to understand that it's like growing pains. It's like we all had growing pains growing up, right? Yeah. And they weren't really that pleasant. But we knew, you know, I'm sure you had more growing pains than I did, because I'm pretty short. But, you know, we knew when we were going through those growing pains that at the end we would be the height in which we wanted to be, that we didn't want to be as short as we were. And, you know, we were able to, you know, grow out of that process. This is the same thing. And, you know, when you have these conversations, you're going to have growing pains that if you do it right, if you go through it, you will end up growing. And abstaining is basically you're abdicating your role in the growth process. And you're basically saying that I don't feel comfortable and I don't want to be a part. And the abstention is basically a no vote. So he is essentially rejected the idea that racism was a public health crisis, that there was an issue there, that, you know, that your Black students and your Latinx students and your Indigenous students matter. And that should not be unnoticed by those of you who live in Cuyahoga Falls.
Yeah, I definitely don't think it is unnoticed. And there is a defensiveness that we see from people, you know, surrounding this conversation that very often turns into anger and sometimes even violence. Certainly countrywide we see that, but I mean, there was a protest here where there were some young kids who were actually assaulted by a kind of a middle-aged couple of people. I don't have a lot of details about that, but it did happen. People were arrested and went to court and whatever. So, you know, that's certainly problematic. But the growing pains that you talk about, I think, well, let me say this. There is that defensiveness. But I also think that, and it could be that the two are related, but what I was going to say is that a lot of times this gets turned into a political thing. Sometimes Yes. It could be that it gets turned into a political thing because people want to make an excuse for their defensiveness. They don't, they're afraid of being called racist. They don't want to be canceled or whatever. So they make it a political issue. And my feeling in our conversation for this podcast was that, the board member, David Martin, who abstained from voting for the resolution, felt that it was too political or something. But the argument, I think, against that is that in abstaining from the vote, he made it political as well.
He made it political, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, Alex, I would say I think it's honorable that you are attempting to make an excuse or figure out what's the reasoning behind the no vote, or I'm sorry, the abstention, which is essentially a no vote. But I don't think that, you know, if we're truly honest and about committing ourselves to equity and committing ourselves to rooting out racism or even any problem, let's say the problem or the concern or crisis is not racism, it's some other issue. In order for us to address it, we have to first acknowledge and call it out as an issue. You can't do anything about something that you don't see as an issue. And so by abstaining, you essentially abdicate yourself from the conversation of saying that I do not see it as an issue. That perpetuation is what makes racism a thing that continues to breathe and take over all of our institutions.
I agree. And I would, you know, put simply, I think that the a decision to abstain is an act of cowardice. I really do.
I mean, it could be. I mean, so it, cowardice is one thing. That is a sense of you feeling as though you're afraid of something, perhaps. You're afraid of the repercussions. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's afraid of repercussions, you know, or anyone, is, if they abstain, is afraid of repercussions. It could mean something even deeper than that. It could mean that this matter is not important enough for me to give any more thought to, or give any more energy or opportunity for space in my world. That is even more dangerous, because that's being complicit to racism and how we see it play out in our society and in our systems.
Yeah, the whole silence is violence thing, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay, so I sent you a clip of our conversation from our episode last week, wherein we discussed a Cuyahoga Falls police officer who 12 years ago apparently attended a Halloween costume in blackface. The context is that he was dressed as a character called B.A. Baracus from the
18.
Yeah, the 18. Who, the actor who portrayed that character was Mr. T. The detective, Brandon Good, was a white officer in Cuyahoga Falls who was dressed up like Mr. T. And then two of his colleagues, other officers in the department, were dressed as other characters from the A-Team. Can we talk briefly about the issue of blackface? Because I want to clarify that, you know, one of the reasons I was interested in having you on was because we have acknowledged multiple times on our podcast that we're a group of white people, usually with just maybe one woman, but the rest of us are white men. And we had, you know, we live streamed two different protests in Cuyahoga Falls, as well as a speech from Sonny Matthews, who joined us in, I think, our fourth episode, you know, to talk to us about all these issues surrounding Black Lives Matter. I'm sure you know Sonny. She's a very well-known local activist. But, you know, in the midst of this flashpoint surrounding issues of racism and police brutality in this country, this kind of came home to roost in our own community with this officer wearing blackface. So, you know, in light of our discussion in the podcast last week, I wanted to reach out and see if you'd be willing to talk to us about not only this issue of blackface, but also the conversation we had, because I think it's an interesting sort of look at what it's like to see a group of white people struggling with this. And we're well-intentioned white people, I would argue. So can we talk about the issue of blackface first?
Yeah. So I'm going to just in 2 minutes or less, I just want to just give a brief overview of what blackface is, so that people can get a sense of why it's culturally insensitive, minimally. If you don't think it's racist, you should at least believe that it's culturally insensitive.
Sure.
And so here, the history is that you had white individuals who would play black people on TV, but they would play them in a racist way, in the way in which white Americans saw the inhumanity of black people. And so the other piece of that is you exclude a whole race of individuals from even being actors or actresses. And so that's another issue, but that comes later. But it's rooted in that racism and that inhumanity. So you see in blackface, you see the big lips exaggerated by the pink of the lips, making it bigger. You also see the big eyes. All of these things are, you know, tropes that have been used to try to dehumanize our very existence and try to get us closer and closer to a caricature, close to a ape or chimpanzee or a monkey. And so that is where blackface really came from. And so they would use shoe polish or some other type of form. And this actually is seen as the father or grandfather or the birth of minstrel shows, as well as those shows like Step and Fetch It, where you see black people or, you know, people in blackface, white performers basically playing characters that kind of play out negative stereotypes of black people. All of this created a system that perpetuated racism and discrimination, as well as, the word that I'm looking for, I just blanked, but it's perpetuated the whole stereotype. That's the word that I was looking for.
Yeah. And so fast forward, 100 years, really, maybe more, we are seeing even in recent years and even this year, people sort of coming out or being exposed as having worn blackface at some point. Famously, Jimmy Fallon recently had to sort of eat crow a little bit because, you know, he had portrayed Chris Rock in blackface on, I think, an episode of SNL. We had the governor of, I think it was Virginia or West Virginia, I can never remember which, Ralph Northam, who was found to have been wearing blackface in a photo from a medical school yearbook sometime, I think, in the 70s or 80s. And then we had this officer, you know, at a Halloween party in Cuyahoga Falls in our own community, you know, dressed up like Mr. T. So where does the conversation go from the explanation of the history and the ways in which blackface historically produced the conditions for putting forth a racist agenda, and people, you know, in popular culture wearing blackface, or in our community doing it as like a Halloween costume?
Right. Well, I think the biggest thing is we have to acknowledge that there is a such thing as right and there's a such thing as legal, right? And so there are a lot of things that were legal and acceptable but was not right. And we are coming to a time where our code, our moral code and our code of ethics are coming closer to the side of what's right and seeing people for the dignity and the humanity that they are. And so when you see the people condemning people from the past wearing blackface, and you hear conversations about, well, we shouldn't be judging people based off things they did 50 years ago. And in fact, we really should be looking at people as total people. So yes, we should acknowledge if they understand now that what they did was wrong. But we also need to also say that it's important that we push people to say that doing right back then was something that not everyone did. And if you were wrong back then, we should still call it out. We shouldn't ignore it, because what happens is you build this system of racism, this institution of racism within these different spheres. And that's what happens. And so in order to move forward, to just kind of sum this up, I think we have to be willing to acknowledge where we were in the past, acknowledge that there's a difference between right and legal and acceptable. Things that are acceptable to the mainstream does not always mean that it's right, but it may be legal. And then there's a such thing as being just. And those things can be polar opposites and have been in many cases across this country in different times. And so we need to be able to acknowledge that and then move forward to saying, how do we help each other to see each other as human beings, to see each other as equals, as far as, you know, being able to exist in this society. And then how do we educate each other? Because the biggest problem is when people feel as though they can't have these conversations and that you're cut off to learning. Because learning happens through experience. Learning happens through exposure. Learning happens through conversation. And if we cut them off completely, then that doesn't happen. Now, I will say, and I'll end on this, cancel culture is real. And unfortunately, in 2020, if you have not arrived and you don't have you good friends, yourself good friends, then, you know, you could get in a situation where you could be a part of the process of being canceled. And because people are exhausted from having to explain themselves, people are exhausted that we're in 2020 and we still have to say racism is a thing, call it out. We still have to say Black Lives Matter and have to explain that Black Lives Matter does not mean that white lives, Asian lives, or any other lives don't matter. But it basically highlights and illuminates the fact that if we can't say Black Lives Matter, if you can't say that, then you're a part of the problem. You're a part of the system of racism. Because when we walk outside our houses as a Black man, we hear a lot of times, I hear a lot of times people say, oh, I don't see color. Well, in actuality, what that means is you don't see me because I am Black and I am a man. So that's what I think, how we move forward. We have to see people. We have to acknowledge that the past happened. And then we have to be willing to move on together.
Yeah, Sunny said something very similar when we talked to her, and in her speech in downtown Cuyahoga Falls.
Yeah, and Susan at the in the last episode, or I don't know what episode that was.
Suzanne Searle, yeah, in our last Fallscast. Yep.
Yes. I'm trying to remember what she said. She said, "If you know better, you do better." Shout out to you, Susan. I think that's where we are at a point of time right now. We are in a point of time where it's 2020. We should know better, and therefore we should do better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the case of a police officer, you know, especially with tensions being what they are with the police, it's important to understand, you know, that scrutinizing a police officer is because we don't want somebody who is insensitive or potentially racist to be a police officer, right?
Right.
So if you're wearing blackface and you're a police officer, that's going to get some attention because we don't need people who are, you know, insensitive at one level or racist at worst to be, you know, policing communities where we have people of color. So
and can I...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Can I just say that I can acknowledge and appreciate someone going through the growth process and being a different person today than they were 20, 30 years ago. I can acknowledge and appreciate that. And I think it's humbling when someone can do that and say that. But I think, though, it is incumbent upon the Cuyahoga Falls Police Department to review these three officers and their arrests, their stops, their history, and their actions on the force, as well as complaints that have been filed, including those that have been deemed unsubstantiated. There needs to be a whole total review of all of their history, because that could tell you a complete picture. That could tell you a different story. Now that you have a little bit more understanding of this person may have harbored some insensitive or implicit biases, if you will, at minimum.
Yeah, and I mean, it. The sense is that there's an investigation. There are promotions that have been put on hold. I have to think that the that public relations and unions, or the union, are, you know, involved in this conversation internally. So we're going to see what happens. But, you know, our conversation with the Falls Cast surrounding this, we had missteps. We really did. And we acknowledged that in our conversation for the episode that you're going to be a part of here today. I really wanted to get your perspective on that, if you have any commentary for us as far as what you heard in our conversation. And I want to make clear, too, because it's a cliche, you know, for white people to be asking for forgiveness. That's not what we want. But I'm very curious to hear what you thought of the conversation. I know that you were moved by what Suzanne said.
Yeah, I actually, you know, I'll say this. And I'm a diversity expert. My PhD is in equity, basically race and culture and education. And so I'm an educator. And what I heard was a group of individuals who were trying to have a conversation to understand a very complex issue that none of them, even in I think Suzanne and then her husband, or I don't know if that was her husband. I just made that assumption.
Her husband is in there. Yeah, that's Mike.
Yes. So, you know, they basically were sharing, and I think one of them, maybe both of them, shared that, you know, that they acknowledge that they're not a part of the Black community, and maybe they shouldn't be thinking or talking about this. But, you know, here we are having this conversation. I think we should be very cautious to condemn people from having conversations, right?
Absolutely.
So I thought that your conversations was individuals outside of that culture trying to grapple with what I think this whole country is trying to grapple with. And if I say you made any missteps, I think that your biggest misstep was just not having a full conversation about it. And, you know, a lot of it was on the surface. And I think that it's hard to go deep about issues when, one, it's not your expertise. You don't study it. You're not in it every day, or you don't live it. And so I think as my thought is, none of you said anything so egregious that I'm going to cancel you. So I think
thank
you
for that.
No problem. I think you should at least, you know, be somewhat relieved of that. But more importantly, I think that by you acknowledging that you didn't have the full conversation and inviting me, I think it can't just stop there. If you want to continue having these conversations, you know, it's one of the reasons why I started my online show.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it's basically about that. You know, we have people in this world, especially in America, who see Black men specifically, and they always see crime. They always see thug. You know, I'm a Black man with a PhD, but I grew up in what's called the hood. I grew up in poverty. I grew up with where there's high crime, and that's where I was raised. And now I live in Akron, in the northwest side of Akron, which is considered more middle class than anything. So I'm not necessarily around the crime necessarily in my neighborhood, the high crime, I should say, because there is still crime. But, you know, people see me today and they make assumptions. And they say, oh, you're not one of them. But in fact, I am. And just that conversation about not being one of them is a problem. So I want to be able to expose people on my show to different perspectives of Black men, the way we live. And you're not going to agree with everything. I mean, there's people been on my show so far that I didn't necessarily agree with either. But I think it's important that you see the fullness and the multifacets of Black men specifically, to defy the stereotypes that we're all thugs and we all can't think for ourselves and that we're criminals and we're just waiting to commit the next crime.
Yeah, and so that's Perspectives with Black Men, and it's specifically broadcast via your Facebook page for the show. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And you can just find it. If you go to Facebook and type in Perspectives Black Men, it'll come up.
Awesome. Yeah, I did, like I said to you before we started recording, I listened to a couple episodes, and it really is great. Something interesting that came up in our conversation today for the Fallscast was that Suzanne said that, you know, she had come from an area where there was very little diversity, and she mm-hmm. described Cuyahoga Falls as being much more diverse than where she came from, and that was a shock to me. I mean, you know, this is a city that literally is sometimes colloquially known as Caucasian Falls.
Yeah.
So for this to be diverse compared to where she came from, but there are a lot of people who come from those communities. So,
yes,
you know, it's just, you talk about growing pains. You know, the world is going through growing pains right now, culturally, you know, and I think it's a good thing. And, so, you know, we're really happy you were willing to come talk to us today, and I hope everybody will go check out Perspectives, and we look forward to hearing from you again soon, man.
No problem. I appreciate that, and if there's anyone out there who is Black and have conversations or thoughts about racism, I actually am a researcher as well, and myself and my research team, we have a research study out there. So if you go to Perspectives with Black Men page on Facebook and you like it, you can see the link there to the survey. So fill it out.
Awesome. NJ Akbar, Dr. NJ Akbar, thanks again so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Dr. Alex Hall.
All right, man. Thank you so much.
All right. You too. Have a great day.
All right. See ya. Fallscast is a production of the Falls Free Press in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Please check out the Falls Free Press at fallsfreepress.com or on social media at facebook.com/fallsfreepress or @falls_free on Twitter or Instagram. We thank you for listening to this episode, which was recorded and edited by Alex Hall. Please subscribe to our podcast and tell your Cuyahoga Falls friends and family so that they can listen as well.